Gerald Horn on Armed Struggle and update on the DRC. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Show Muzi Mtali. The music in the background is Africa by Alice Coltrane. Today the show features a recent discussion by Dr. Gerald Horn. In the conversation, he draws critical distinctions between armed propaganda, armed self-defense, and armed struggle, all of which he places in the global context of anti-war activism, the Cold War, and African liberation. Professor Gerald Horn is currently the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Dr. Horn has written nearly 40 books dealing with the confluence of African American history, communist history, the struggle for liberation, internationalism, imperialism, colonialism, racism, white supremacy, and fascism. The conversation features introduction by Dr. Greg Carr of Howard University and interventions by filmmaker, educator, Dr. Haile Gerima of Sankofa. And the conversation took place a few weeks ago at Sankofa Video and Books. Here is the conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn, and the introduction is by Dr. Greg Carr of Howard University.
Haile Gerima, Shrikiana Gerima, and the institution that you all have built here is truly our university in this neighborhood. You came because of Howard, and you brought the spirit that Howard is associated with across the street for safekeeping. And that allows that institution across the street to have some refuge, a place where we renew and recharge. So I know people have already done this, but could we have, at least for the folks who are watching, of which they are legion, don't go anywhere, I'm gonna get you like you got me. Let's have a round of applause for this brother right here. The reason I'm saying that, thank you, is because, as I said, I was coming here listening. I'm intended to do that. This safe space projects all over the world, always has. The first time that many of us encountered the Garimas was through, of course, the master film Sankofa. And it's hard to believe that's, what, almost 30 years ago.
No, 50. What are you talking
50
about?
50, yeah. In the planning and the work.
Maybe 39. It's 1993.
93. 40. Yeah.
40.
41. 42. 42 years. Good Lord. And in that process, the companion film, Footprints of Pan-Africanism, the documentary that goes along with it, they really are a companion, Shrikiana's film. I just want to say that we are gathered here in increasing numbers because we have been provoked into realizing and really renewing our greatness. Something is being done in this city, in this country, in the world that is a favor. The facades are being dropped, and they don't know who we are, but they're about to find out. So I want to say I love you, I thank you. And because this is this, he won't beat me up until tomorrow or late tonight.
Tomorrow.
Okay, that's good. I'm going to move this chair, skip over. I'm going to move it here in a second because these two brothers, if you were here a couple of months ago for the discussion on Amiri Baraka and related things, then you heard Skip talk. This brother, who inspires so many of us and instructs so many of us very quietly, who has done a lot of great and important work, beginning with his very young days as a student. Here we are on the first day of so-called Negro History Week or Black History Month. And it was, if memory serves me correct, Skip, you probably know this. In fact, we might hear this from you in a way we won't hear it anywhere else. We know Carter Woodson in 1926 with Negro History Week. We're increasingly knowing Mary Church Terrell, who in this city in 1897 promoted Douglas Day, which in many ways became the precursor to Negro History Week, as she and Nanny Helen Burroughs and Mary McLeod Bethune, who was very good friends with Carter Woodson, began to work together. And Dr. Woodson then attached Frederick Douglass's birthday and the preceding Douglass Day to Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and we get Negro History Week. We know about the Q's and how they helped him and all that. But we might not know that in Ohio, Kent State, I think it was, students in 1968, 69 demanded that perhaps we should take this out to a whole month. Do you know that story? So we're going to hear that story then from somebody, because that is what led to the impetus that led eventually in conversations around the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, and then ultimately the federal recognition a few years later of Black History Month. And that is a story that starts with Black students. And Skip was one of those students who pushed back the barriers in the 60s and unleashed the forces that brought us forward into Black power and the radical global movement, the white latch of which we're still paying for. Thanks, brother. Anyway, and of course, that having been said, the man sitting next to him is really, really beyond category, as Duke Ellington was saying. He's written about Duke Ellington, of course, if you haven't read his book, Jazz and Justice, right, Joni? In fact, he's written about everything. At this point, oh, we used to say 36 books, but he won't stop writing, so now it's like 40-some books. An incredible force, this brother who is a trained lawyer and then got a PhD, who combined that intellectual work, a son of Mississippi by way of St. Louis. So he knows the Missouri River and the Mississippi River well, has written about that. A man from a family that is truly remarkable. If you haven't read his sister's book about their mother, you should. A man who, after matriculating at prestigious Ivy League institutions that if this were today, I'm not sure you would get in or any of the rest of us. But fortunately, this was the period when skipping in was kicking down doors. So Gerald Horn was able to hang out it for a minute at Princeton and then back on the West Coast and then Columbia, and ultimately take those tools the way they should be taken, whether it's Howard or Columbia, whether it's Tennessee State, where I went to school, or the University of Tennessee. Every university should be on the periphery of community work. We only go there to get some skills to bring back to the base, which is the community. And Gerald Horn has done that incredibly with his work helping to lead the National Council of Black Lawyers and the work in the anti-apartheid and labor movements. We saw the transition recently of Bill Lucy, one of the great leaders in that movement, with his work as a writer, as an activist, as a man who I became aware of. I think the first book I read that you wrote was Black and Red on W.E.B. Du Bois, and he's written several since. And now, today, we are here for these two books, Armed Struggle and African Americans, A New History of the USA. I got my copies in here. They're the only ones haven't been signed by him. I'm going to get mine signed like a lot of y'all. Jonathan, I hope y'all got some books back there. I see Moise and them, y'all going to sell out. This is a novel book because I don't know whose idea this was. You'll tell us in a minute. Maybe it's Tiana Paris's, to put together the first chapters of about a dozen and a half of his previous books, write a master narrative connecting them. And with all due respect to a history that does not begin, as he writes in the introduction in 1619, no shade at all. We need all the work. And he's very generous in that. But to remind ourselves that we are global people in a global movement, our beginning begins millennia ago. It was just interrupted by this condition of the last 500 years. And that ultimately we will transcend this by tapping into our long memory. One final thing before I get a mic to Skip so we can get out of the way and listen to the people we're here to listen to tonight. In this moment now of disruption where media has created every point of entry you can imagine, I understand there's a Hillman or TikTok university, it cracks me up. It's a beautiful thing because it lets people have flashes. The man has mastered writing. He's been an activist for decades. He's everywhere all the time, globally, as you see in his writing. And then when social media opened up and technology, now he is everywhere in social media. I've never seen anything like this. Every day of the week, he got a radio show out in the West Coast that is broadcast as a podcast. He's on the Activist News Network every day. He does Around the Horn and connects everything. We need to hear about Congo tonight, among other things. Every day, in addition to writing and moving and traveling and researching, now he has turned into the public professor for all of us. So tonight, we will hear from the People's Professor Gerald Horn. Brother Skip, please take it over. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I go back to 1968 with this brother. I was at Antioch College and he was at Princeton. But now, what is that, 50 years later, I met Howie in 1977 at the Cuban Embassy. I'm not sure he remembers it, but I'm so proud of what him and his wife had built for this institution. But I know all y'all here to hear Brother Horn, and he's been excited. So I'm going to pass the mic right to him because he got a lot to talk about.
I got it. Well, thank you for those prefaces. Thanks to Sankofa and Haile for inviting me and arranging this audience. Thanks to Brother Carr from Howard University for the generous introduction. Thank you to my brother Skip for accompanying me here this evening. So first I'm going to talk about the book on my right, your left. And in many ways, if I'm not able to do it in the brief time I have here, we should talk about the implications of some of these historical themes that I put forward in this book for today's moment. To begin with, this book deals with a basic contradiction in terms of U.S. history and Black American history. That contradiction being that we live in this settler colonial society. As you know, at a certain moment, you had Europeans invading this continent, ousting, uprooting indigenous, liquidating them in many instances, and then replacing them with settlers. And then, of course, dragging, kicking, and screaming across the Atlantic, enslaved Africans to work for free. Now, settler colonialism, based upon this invasion of settlers, was based on class collaboration. In this book, I talk about the first episode in London's settler colonialism in the 1580s in what they call North Carolina before Virginia in this area in the beginning of the 17th century. And it was a heterogeneous mixture of folks from different class backgrounds, the poor, the middle class, shopkeepers, workers, declassed elements, but all sponsored by the 1%. But they were united in this project of mutual enrichment, which for many did occur. And that class collaboration, I argue, was also exemplified on November 5th, 2024, when the Tangerine Tyrant got 77 million votes. Now, notwithstanding some of the protestations of our friends on the left, the math doesn't add up to suggest that 77 million out of a nation of 330 million constitutes 1% of the 330 million. Now, this is more than the 1%. This is a mass base. And you would not be far wrong if you were to suspect that if we're not careful, we're about to enter a dangerous new era of something that has hardly been witnessed on this soil since the 19th century, a kind of proto-fascism, in other words. That's class collaboration. Whereas Africans brought kicking and screaming by virtue of being persecuted and oppressed had to engage in class struggle, uprisings on a repetitive basis, malingering at work, seeking to organize various forms of resistance. And one of the many reasons that we have been treated so atrociously, and the list is legion, you should also add the point that class collaboration and class struggle, which is what we were involved in, they do not mix together easily. That's one point. A second point is religion. And that's where this book goes back in time, not only to the origins of Christianity 2,000 years ago, but Judaism before that, the origins of Islam approximately 1,400 years ago, the expulsion of the Jewish community from England at the end of the 13th century, and put a pin on that because we'll come back to it. And of course, the conflict between Protestants and Catholics in the 1500s, which allows for the rise of England. Because we should not take for granted the demography of this hemisphere, where most of the people do not speak English. They, of course, are the result of the Spanish intervention post-1492, particularly in Mexico, and, of course, the Portuguese intervention in Brazil in the 1500s, But what happens is that with the secession of Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, Martin Luther from the Catholic Church about 500 years ago, you had erupting a round robin of religious wars between Protestant England, because England adopted the Protestant faith early on in the 1530s, igniting conflict with the Catholic powers led by Spain and Portugal. Protestant England was the underdog, Protestant England barely escaping overthrown by the Catholics in the 1580s. And so improvising, perhaps like Max Roach on a good day, what happens is that Protestant England moves to incorporate into a new identity those with whom they had been warring, particularly the Irish Catholics, particularly the Scottish Catholics. And at one time, to cut to the chase, you had the Protestants burning Catholics at the stake in the 1500s, and 300 years later, you had Protestants and Catholics joining hands under the new identity politics that is whiteness and white supremacy, burning Africans at the stake, particularly in this region, particularly in Dixie. And so what happens in terms of the United States in particular is that this original identity politics that unites English and Irish and English and Scots and English and Welsh under this new identity of whiteness once they cross the Pacific, the remit is expanded, and therefore those who have been warring on the shores of Europe, German versus British, German versus Pole, Pole versus Russian, Serb versus Croat, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian, Protestant French versus Catholic French, even Egyptian Christians, even Lebanese Christians like Ralph Nader, for example. Of course, Hoda, who just retired from Today Show, she's Egyptian Christian, for example. They're all incorporated into this new identity of whiteness, which is basically, as I said, a sort of a class collaborationist identity. And that is the story of the United States of America. Now, that's the sort of early chapters of this book, is laying that foundation. But what I talk about is this transition from religion to race to class, because what happens is that with the triumph of the Anglosphere, the Londoners in the 1600s, you have the embarking on the race project. Because of course they juxtapose this new identity of whiteness with blackness, for example, with we who are deemed to be blacks scheduled for working for free, the unpaid sector of the working class, in other words. That's disrupted by the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, a staggering blow to the race project, for example, and helping to ignite a new project, which is the class project. It's no accident that once slavery is abolished, you have the acceleration of the organizing of unions, the creation of the 8-hour workday, for example, which many of us still enjoy. I understand that you folks in D.C. might be presented with a different option. But what's happened in the recent decades, of course, is that there have been staggering blows inflicted on the class project. And so, not unsurprisingly, you're going to see a resurgence of religious bigotry, and you're going to see a resurgence of racist bigotry. And of course, those who are paying attention can see that already happening. So in any case, I go on to this book, in addition to talking about the Haitian Revolution, the role of U.S. enslavers in helping to create the largest black population this side of Nigeria, that is to say Brazil, because U.S. enslavers helped to drag Africans across the Atlantic. They were mainly responsible for that demographic earthquake of the creation of this massive black Brazilian population. Going on into the 20th century with the rise of many black people in the United States who sign on to the class project, not only intellectuals like Robeson and Du Bois, for example, but also trade union leaders who eventually were ousted from this land, such as Ferdinand Smith, who was born in Jamaica and helps to found one of the most powerful unions in the United States, the National Maritime Union. But that runs afoul of the post-World War II, post-1945 so-called Red Scare. In any case, that's fundamentally that book. As Greg put it, it's taking introductions from about 16 different books, and then I write an introduction trying to tie them all together, as I just did, with the operative rubric being this transition from religion to race to class, with class now in retreat, the race project returning with a vengeance with the Tangerine Tyrant, and religious bigotry not far behind, I'm afraid to say. Now, this book deals with the Southland, deals with Southern California. It not only deals with the Panthers. I've noticed in terms of talking about this book, which has been out for about 6 months now, people really want to talk about the Panthers, so I won't disappoint. So I'll talk about the Panthers. But it talks about more than that. The NAACP plays a major role in this book, because what happens in the 1950s is that the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, for those who may not be familiar, the large black mass organization, it decides that as a matter of survival, it has to go along with the Red Scare, that is to say, routing leftists. They even rout W.E.B. Du Bois, their founder. He's kicked to the curb. They turn against Paul Robeson, the tallest tree in our forests, for example. He's persecuted, isolated, marginalized. And a leading character in this book is Franklin Williams, who is sort of the leader of the NAACP on the West Coast. And he's rewarded by becoming U.S. ambassador to Ghana. And he's placed there in 1966 when Kwame Nkrumah, the founding father of Ghana, Ghanaian independence post-1957, he's ousted in 1966 with a military coup, U.S. CIA complicity. Franklin Williams disclaims any knowledge of what happens. Many are not so sure. But when the NAACP turns against forces to their left, such as Robeson, for example, what that serves to do is that they basically make a bet. I don't know if they realized that at the time, but they made a huge bet that they could have an alliance with the liberal wing of the rulers of the United States of America, and that would lead to civil rights concessions that would flow indefinitely. And they seem to be onto something in 1954 when the U.S. Supreme Court, under Earl Warren, former governor of California, issued the Brown versus Board of Education decision saying that Jim Crow was invalid. That sets the basis for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, these other concessions. But the NAACP, number one, didn't appear to realize that the liberals who they made this alliance with were not destined to be influential forever, as we now realize in 2025, and that some of the liberals today are going to have to lawyer up, as they say in the United States, in order to avoid prison or exile. And so that was one mistake that they made. And then the other mistake was that the civil rights concessions that the liberals helped to engineer was a response to the international situation. A major theme of these books, and in fact a lot of my work, is that for black people in particular, the international situation is critical because we face very adverse circumstances domestically, as exemplified by my earlier introduced trope of we not necessarily fitting into this class collaborationist regime. What I mean by that point is that when these civil rights concessions in the 1950s began to flow, The United States was under unremitting pressure. African nations were surging to independence. I mentioned Ghana, 1957. Caribbean nations are coming to independence. Many of them, of course, are coming across the street to Howard University. Some of them are rather outraged by the Jim Crow that they're subjected to. I talk about that book, that in my book on D.C., Revolting Capital, which is in the back. And so the United States feels that it has to do something. And so that creates a dynamic that leads to this agonizing retreat from the more horrible aspects of Jim Crow. But the problem is that that international situation that drove the civil rights concessions no longer obtains. And once again, we're faced with a different situation, but the NAACP and those who made that fateful decision to engage in that compromise of 1954 seem to be not able to adjust and adapt to this new situation. And that brings us to the Panthers. At least the iteration I talk about comes into existence in Northern California in 1966 under Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. Even though they're oftentimes grouped under the Black Power rubric, it's fair to suggest that Huey P. Newton and many of the Panther leaders, they saw themselves as being part of the Worldwide Socialist Project because they were deeply influenced by African liberation movements, the MPLA of Angola, Frelimo of Mozambique, Amilcar Cabral, who just his assassination, of course, Guinea-Bissau, Cabo Verde, Cape Verde. We just marked his assassination January 1973. And this, of course, helped to make them dangerous because those of us who studied the life of Martin Luther King, we recognize, for example, that what helped to make him dangerous was speaking out against the Vietnam War, what helped to make Malcolm dangerous to a certain extent were these international connections. And I should also say that a unique aspect, or not necessarily unique, but a horrific aspect that helps to drive the Panthers into existence is police terror. In other words, I start the book with the scene in Algeria with Kathleen Cleaver and her comrade Donald Cox of the Panthers, a meeting with envoys of then-socialist Czechoslovakia trying to get arms to bring back to this country in order to engage in either armed self-defense, armed propaganda, or armed struggle. Armed propaganda meaning what happens in the spring of 1967 when the Panthers arm march into the California legislature to make a dramatic statement, armed propaganda. And of course, we all know what armed self-defense is. They also were able to get arms from the Vietnamese for said purposes. And in some ways, this not only reflects a direct response to the terrorist brutality of the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department. In some ways, they make Metropolitan Police Department of Washington, D.C. seem like Girl Scouts, for example, in terms of their brutality. And that stems in some ways from the geography, because as you know, Southern California is this huge, sprawling region. The Watts Uprising of 1965, which was mostly in the black neighborhood in South Los Angeles, but that black neighborhood is larger in territory than the city of San Francisco. However, the police department feels that they did not have enough manpower, did not have enough officers, so they felt they had to engage in what I call draconian deterrence. That is to say, any encounter with a black person in particular, they make it memorable so that the word can be circulated that you don't want to violate the law because you don't want to confront the LAPD. And that creates this dynamic of police brutality. Some of you are old enough to recall the episode involving black motorist Rodney King a few decades ago when he's captured on camera being given a whooping by officers of the law. Actually, it was the California Highway Patrol in this case. And then when they're acquitted, that leads to a large conflagration in this fire-prone area, as we've just seen in January 2025. There's an outbreak of fires, for example, threatening the very existence of this city.
You're listening to a recent conversation that took place at Sankofa Video and Books with Dr. Gerald Horn. In the conversation, he draws critical distinctions between armed propaganda, armed self-defense, and armed struggle, all of which he places in a global context of anti-war activism, the Cold War, and African liberation. The music in the background is Yarabi by Sona Jobate. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So there are many aspects that go into the creation of the Black Panthers, the uniqueness of the police terror, the fact that there is substantial funding from the entertainment community. That is to say that Jane Fonda, who's still in the land of the living, was a major force in terms of raising funds for the Panthers, for example, although she had to somewhat apologize for doing it in order to keep her career going. A number of screenplay writers, for example, I mentioned this book, Dalton Trumbo. You might have seen his film Spartacus, which came out some decades ago. One of the most talented screenwriters that Hollywood has produced, at least. He was a major funder of the Panthers, also a major funder of the Communist Party, too, for that matter, because he had been a member of the Communist Party. Ditto for John Howard Lawson. You might recall his films, Sahara, Blockade, wrote the screenplays, Cry the Beloved Country, the first anti-apartheid drama starring Sidney Poitier and Canada Lee, filmed on site in South Africa. Sidney Poitier talks about this at length in one of his memoirs. So that's another unique aspect of California, which is this money in the entertainment industry that's in the pockets of conscious artists, actors, and screenplay writers in particular. Directors, not so much. Mostly screenplay writers and actors. And that helps to allow for these breakfast programs. It allows for a number of initiatives. Another aspect of California is this breakneck construction of campuses. That is to say that the University of California system, which is a monumental system of higher education, with campuses being constructed at UCLA about 100 years ago, UC Irvine, Santa Barbara, San Diego in the last half century, for example, attracting Black students such as Angela Davis, who winds up being a graduate student at UCLA. And of course, the scene from the cover of this book involves Jonathan Jackson, who was a comrade of hers, engaged in a militant action at the Marin County Courthouse, where it was thought that he was trying to free his jailed brother, George Jackson. It was a shootout. Jonathan Jackson did not survive. Angela Davis was charged with supplying the guns, but it took a worldwide struggle to make sure that she was not executed. And that struggle attracted the likes of Victor Franklin, Toni Morrison, the Nobel laureate. So universities also are part of the story, because universities also house a number of professors who are conscious, who are able to make contributions, able to influence students in a political direction, in a radical direction. But alas, there were contradictions. There were contradictions between and amongst the Panthers with regard to the suitability of not only armed struggle, but armed self-defense and armed propaganda, leading to rather sharp conflict. There are conflicts ideologically between the Panthers and so-called cultural nationalists, as symbolized by Milana Kerenga, still in the land of the living. You may associate with Kwanzaa, the holiday, noted annually at the end of December, noted once again at the end of December 2024. That conflict led to a shootout at the UCLA campus between these two forces, January 1969, leaving two Panthers slain. Arguably, the Panthers did not survive that shootout.
Certainly.
Another key factor in terms of the story is an institution within walking distance of Sankofa, that is to say its headquarters, speaking of the FBI, who... Apparent incoming director Kash Patel said that as soon as he takes the office, he's going to shut it down, turn it into a museum for the deep state. I don't think he's going to do that, but that's what he said. But in any event, they invented COINTELPRO, as you know, the counterintelligence program, which was designed to disrupt
radical movements,
the Black Liberation Movement in particular. They would send out nasty notes to one faction, saying that this other faction is conspiring to kill you, so you, perhaps you may want to act preemptively, for example. And I don't think the FBI has ever apologized for that, although there have been substantial litigation implicating them. There are volumes of records documenting and detailing their deviltry during this period. So in any case, I think it's fair to say that by the 1970s, the Panthers were limping along. And of course, today, they're no longer with us. Although since that time, there have been iterations of groups that call themselves Panthers. But ideologically, they're not really similar to these early Panthers. Particularly, as I said, one of the hallmarks of the early Panthers was their orientation towards the left, for example, their orientation towards socialism, for example. And the later iterations have not been so oriented for whatever reason. In any case, I think I'll stop there. And if any of you have any comments, or as they say nowadays, not Q&A, but Q&A.
Okay. While you were there, I just want you to one, Robert Williams and,
you know, North Carolina. Do you have it here or how?
Robert
does
Williams, it's funny. This year we're marking the centenary of Robert F. Williams of North Carolina, who was the leader of a NAACP chapter but had to flee, wound up in Cuba, where he started Radio Free Dixie. An analog to Radio Free Europe, so-called, where the United States broadcast into Eastern Europe, into the Soviet Union. Radio Free Dixie broadcast into the United States with music and what I would call propaganda, not in a negative sense, but in a sense of trying to influence people politically. Then he fled Cuba, wound up in China. Then he came back to the United States.
Yeah, but could you go into, you know, the armed struggle?
Yes.
The propaganda armed struggle. I thought he would be the one who is actually the proponent of armed struggle, where he was training people pre the Panthers. I could be wrong.
Oh, but yeah, yeah. He was involved with the Revolutionary Action Movement, which is represented in this book.
Deacons for Defense.
Of course, we could talk about the Deacons for Defense from Louisiana. Robert F. Williams is also involved in Republic of New Africa, for example, which had a strong base in Detroit. There are books been written about Robert F. Williams, including Radio Free Dixie by Tim Tyson. There's a documentary about Robert F. Williams, which you can probably find online.
You've just been listening to a recent discussion by Dr. Gerald Horn at Sankofa Video and Books. The conversation centered around Dr. Gerald Horn's new publication, Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and the 70s. Also in the conversation was an introduction by Dr. Greg Carr of Howard University and interventions by filmmaker, educator, Dr. Haile Gerima of Sankofa. The full discussion is on Sankofa Video and Books' YouTube page. The music in the background is Not Yet Uhuru by Aleta Mburu. And now, as we commemorate Women's History Month and International Women's Day on March 8, and following up from our show last week, Maurice Carney, executive director and co-founder of Friends of the Congo, provides an update on the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and he looks at the violence against women during the M23 takeover of Bukavu and Goma in the DRC. Here is Maurice Carney. Maurice Carney, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's my pleasure. Pleasure to be with you, Moise.
Thanks. And we wanted you to brief us on the current situation in the Congo, particularly in the eastern part of Congo, with Bukavu and Goma, where the M23 has come in. And as everybody knows, that's the group that's being backed by Rwanda. If you could give us the update of the current situation. We talked about the extent last week. Wanted to see where the situation, what the situation is like this week from your contacts.
Yeah, the situation remains dire. The Rwandan soldiers and the M23 have captured the two provinces, North Kivu and South Kivu, at least the major cities in both provinces, and a good swath of territory, which has made life living hell for the civilian population, and particularly women and children, as have been reported in the news. Within the first 7 days of Rwandan soldiers and M23 capturing the city of Goma, population of 2 million inhabitants, 3,000 people were killed. And it's a horrific situation where women who were in the prison were, but 150 of them or so were raped and set afire. So this is just a tremendous amount of suffering, fear, concern, now that large swath of Eastern Congo and those two major cities, Goma, population of 2 million, Bukavu, population of 1 million, are under the control of the Rwandan soldiers and M23.
Yeah, and as you said, that the effects on women and children, and even before the war, of course, and as we've been talking about, the continuous aggression against the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, women bear the brunt, women and children bear the brunt of the onslaught against this country.
Yes. You know, if you look in the displacement camps, there are about 7 million internally displaced people as a result of the war of aggression and plunder led by Rwanda government. Most of the people in the displacement camp are women and children. And women, in particular, have been victims of rape. Rape has been used as a weapon, a strategy of war. We often say that this war has been fought, you know, on the bodies of women. And this latest, rise in violence has borne that out. That Dr. Denis Mukwege, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate from the Congo, he was reporting and confirmed by Doctors Without Borders that the sexual violence that we see unfolding today in the Congo is as high as ever, probably the highest ever. So it's an incredibly perilous time, you know, for women in the Congo. And that's why we want to use this year's International Women's Month and International Women's Day to raise global consciousness, to pique people's interest about what's happening. The devastation that's taking place among women in the Congo. So, as you know, this March 8th, Saturday, March 8th, International Women's Day, be having a demonstration in Washington, D.C., that being led by the Congolese diaspora, is going to elevate the Congolese woman and the trials that they're going through, and in a lot of respects, how they're combating the challenges and overcoming them.
Oh, you said that the march is going to be on the Saturday, this Saturday, March 8th, which is International Women's Day. And what are the specifics of that march?
Well, the specifics of the march, just in terms of the logistics, it would be at start at 1 p.m. in front of the Rwandan Embassy, 1714 New Hampshire Avenue Northwest. And the marchers would move from the Rwandan Embassy to the White House, where they'll gather in front of the White House. And they'll be making, you know, certain demands, really demands that the entire world has been making for the past few weeks. For Rwandan soldiers to immediately leave the Congo. They're occupying two cities and a swath of territory in the country, virtually the size of Rwanda itself. Two, that the U.S. government cease to provide aid to the Rwandan government that's ostensibly fueling the conflict. Three, they're calling for a ceasefire. Four, the marchers are calling for an embargo on minerals that are being sold out of the Congo, which is being funneled through Rwanda. So they're calling an embargo on the minerals coming out of that Rwanda is selling into the global market. The M23 and Rwandan soldiers captured one of the largest coltan mines in their latest territory grab. And they captured one of the largest coltan mines in the Congo. So those are some of the demands. And equally important, they're calling on people of goodwill throughout the globe to support the humanitarian, urgent humanitarian intervention in the Congo, in the East of Congo, to help, you know, particularly the women and the children. And so those are some of the demands of the marchers that they'll be coming out on Saturday.
And again, it's Maurice Carney. He is the executive director and co-founder of Friends of the Congo. And we're looking at the DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo, an update on the situation in the DRC, particularly as it affects women. The aggression against Congo as it affects women. And I don't know if you have any other closing remarks for people here, and what are Congolese saying how folks in the United States should be in solidarity with Congolese?
Yes, the Congolese community is calling on people, not just in the DMV, but throughout the U.S. To join them in putting pressure on the U.S. government to end its support of Rwanda, whether through aid or military, or you name it. Calling on people to put pressure on those institutions or individuals who are for all intents and purposes, covering for the crimes or cleansing the crimes that the Rwandan government is committing in the Congo. Rwanda committed mass atrocities, war crimes, crimes against humanity, United Nations said, you know, even genocide. And Rwanda seeks to cleanse those crimes by is entering into arrangements like with the National Basketball Association, for example, entertainers like Kendrick Lamar and Dave Chappelle and John Legend go to Rwanda and perform, and that presents Rwanda in a light that that is, you know, betrays the crimes that it's committing in the Congo. So people calling on average U.S. citizens to be engaged in putting pressure on these institutions and U.S. government, and also calling for folks to support Congolese women, particularly in this year's International Women's Month. We have a special guest that will be coming through to do a tour, Justine Masika, who has written an incredible book about her journey in the Congo. And she'll be in Washington, D.C., in New York, Atlanta, Oakland, San Francisco. So we encourage people to go to our website, friendsofthecongo.org, or go to freecongo.org and support Mama Justine and Congolese women during International Women's Month.
And you also mentioned earlier the other activities that's taking place to refresh our memories.
Yeah. Yes, we have the march on Saturday. We at 1 p.m. in front of the Rwandan embassy, and then we have a number of events that are going to be taking place, you know, throughout the country. So if people just go to freecongo.org, or they can follow us on our social media at Congo Friends on X or Twitter and on Instagram, and then they'll be able to keep up with all of the events and activities that we have for them this month throughout International Women's Month.
Thank you again, Maurice, for being on the show and giving us an update on the current situation in the Congo, particularly as it pertains to women in the Congo in the midst of this aggression against this country.
Thank you. Thank you, Mwiza.
And that was my conversation with Maurice Carney, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Friends of the Congo. He was providing us an update on the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, particularly looking at the violence against women during the aggression against the DRC in the midst of the M23 takeover of Bukavu and Goma in the eastern part of the DRC. The music in the background is Safri by NECA. That's it for African Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Mutale. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zain Alamin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly focusing on the plight of Palestinians, which is followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and that's followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Fonangonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW. And to you for joining us and also for supporting us during our recent Winter Pledge Drive. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Aluta Continua by Mia Makeba, remembering her birthday, which is March 4th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
My people, my people. Open your eyes and answer the call of the drum. Frelimo, Frelimo, Samora Mashe, Samora Mashe, Leska.
Welcome to the WPFW Jazz Calendar, a service brought to you in partnership with Capital Pop. Here's what's going on live around town this week. On Tuesday, March 4, at 7 p.m.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 5th. Here are some headlines. A sharply divided Supreme Court today reinstated a lower court order for the Trump administration to release frozen foreign aid, but it was not clear how quickly the money would start flowing. The Trump administration had appealed U.S. District Judge Amir Ali's deadline to give the federal government until February 26 to pay out $2 billion in aid. The federal government froze foreign aid after an executive order from Trump targeting what he called wasteful programs that do not correspond to his foreign policy goals. The spending freeze has had a devastating impact on even the most urgent life-saving programs around the world. The court's action leaves in place Justice Ali's temporary restraining order that had paused the spending freeze. Justice Ali is holding a hearing tomorrow to consider a more lasting pause. In other news, President Donald Trump delivered a combative campaign-style address before Congress and the American public last night. In the nearly 100-minute speech, Trump bragged about his divisive executive actions and repeated false accusations that drew protests from Democratic lawmakers. He claimed his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, had already found hundreds of billions of dollars in fraud, though his administration has provided no evidence of that. Trump also blamed former President Joe Biden for everything from higher grocery prices to foreign conflicts. Immigration was also a key focus, with Trump stressing crimes allegedly committed by undocumented immigrants and calling for stricter border security. In more news, the U.S. will continue to suspend weapon supplies and intelligence sharing with Ukraine until a date for peace talks with Russia is set, White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said today. The U.S. decision to pause military aid is increasing pressure on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to agree to move ahead with negotiations with Russia to end the war. The pause is unlikely to lead to a sudden collapse of Ukraine's defensive lines, but it could particularly undermine air defenses and precision strike capabilities. Trump's decision to enforce the pause followed an extraordinary clash with President Zelensky last week. And the U.S. and Israel have rejected an Arab plan for the post-war reconstruction of the Gaza Strip that would allow the 2.1 million Palestinians living there to stay in place. The proposal endorsed by Arab leaders at a summit in Cairo is their alternative to President Trump's idea for the U.S. to take over Gaza and permanently resettle its population. The Palestinian Authority and Hamas welcomed the Arab plan, which calls for Gaza to be governed temporarily by a committee of independent experts and for international peacekeepers to be deployed there. But both the White House and Israeli Foreign Ministry said it failed to address realities in Gaza and stood by Trump's plan. In weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 60 degrees, thunderstorms are expected to continue until early evening. In New York City, it is 53 degrees.